Voices and Events. The National Broadcasting Company brings you Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, recorded by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You'll hear John Maragon, Cedric Wirth, Henry Morgan, Adolf Hitler and Neville Chamberlain, and Sir Harry Lauder. These and many others, the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now here's your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
It was the moment everyone in Washington had been waiting for. The question was, what did John Maragon have to say for himself?
On the advice of counsel, I refused to answer the question on the ground that the answer might tend to incriminate me.
Yes, that's about all investigating senators got from the mysterious John Maragon. There were some good-sized bank accounts to be explained in this five percenter's hearing, some conflicting testimony from other witnesses. And how did Maragon get involved with White House aide Harry Vaughan and 5%er James Hunt? The Congress and the nation wanted to know all that, but John Maragon shrugged it off. Questioning by the committee went like this.
Did you ever work for Frankie Costello?
On the advice of counsel, I refused to answer the question on the ground that the answer might tend to incriminate.
Did you ever work for the Whiteley Corporation?
For who?
The Whiteley, W-H-I-T-E-L-Y, Corporation.
Senator McCarthy, on the advice of counsel, I refuse to answer the question on the grounds that my answer might tend to incriminate me.
Have you called anyone anonymously, Mr. Maragon, since you first appeared at the executive session and discussed the matter now being taken up by the committee and made any threats?
On the advice of counsel, Senator, I refuse to answer the question on the ground that the answer might tend to incriminate.
John, you talk less today than I've ever seen you.
I have a question I think probably the witness can answer to break the monotony of his reticence. Do you know General Harry Vaughan?
Yes.
And that's all the senators learned from John Maragon. Next week, General Harry Vaughan.
This week, one of the current investigations by Congress finally reached some conclusions.
For many weeks, the B-36 bomber procurement program has been under fire. A full-dress congressional investigation had been ordered. There were ugly rumors of politics, graft, corruption in connection with the program. Who spread these rumors? Well, a man named Cedric Wirth took credit for that. Cedric Wirth, a one-time fiction writer, and until his suspension this week, a high civilian official of the Navy Department. Yes, said Wirth, he wrote an anonymous memorandum setting forth all the rumors about the B-36. The questioning by the committee was sharp, like this.
I had no intention, and my reading of it indicates I did not impugn the honesty of either Mr. Symington or Mr. Johnson. Impugn certainly their judgment and the propriety of certain of their actions.
What do you mean by propriety?
Whether they did things which in their official position they might well not have done.
Well,
that's
really,
what I mean by
really and truly you're indicating corruption upon their part.
Oh,
you?
No.
Far from that.
Far from that.
No, Cedric Wirth said he did not mean to imply any corruption. But that's what it looked like on the basis of rumor. The entire investigation turned up no facts against the B-36 or the Air Force, and it led Committee Chairman Vinson to say,
there's not been in the judgment of the committee one iota, not one scintilla of evidence offered in these hearings that would support charges or insinuation that collusion, fraud, corruption, influence, or favoritism played any part whatsoever in the procurement of the B-36 bomb.
But that isn't quite all. There's a question of ethics involved here, and no one felt so strongly about it as Defense Secretary Lewis Johnson. Here's how he told it to the Armed Services Committee.
The tendency to malign and defame, to assassinate the reputations of public officials, is to me much the same as a new, growing, and dangerous cancer. The American people are entitled to expect the utmost honest and complete freedom from politics in the conduct of our national security. They are entitled to expect the utmost honesty in the conduct of the officials associated with the Department of Defense. And in turn, I submit to you, the officials of the government are entitled to be free of vicious, unwarranted, and unsupported rumors which unjustifiably bring into question their reputations.
Tempers ran short in Washington this week as the political signs reminded the nation this is a congressional election year.
It's a story that was a year in the making. Going back to last summer in the Democratic National Convention, the controversial civil rights program was put into the Democratic platform, and an angry Southerner stood up to say,
"And you know, or if you don't know, you can learn here and now that without the votes of the South, you cannot elect the President of the United States."
"And we bid you goodbye."
Goodbye, indeed. It was more than that. Many a Southerner bolted to the Dixiecrats, the states' rights Democrats, as they call themselves. They refused support to Harry Truman at election time and were effectively blocking his program in Congress to this day. This week, the Democratic National Committee met in Washington and tossed out some of these renegade Democrats. Here was a political scrap close to the heart of Harry Truman. He went before the National Committee with a fighting speech like this.
"The Democratic Party is a national party and not a sectional party anymore. The tail no longer wags the dog. We won the election last November without New York and without the industrial East and without the solid South, and I'm prouder of that than anything that's ever happened in the history of the country. That doesn't mean that we're not inviting the industrial East and the solid South and all the rest of the country to join the party of the people and help the country go forward."
And of the coming congressional elections, the president had this to say.
"We brought in a number of able and distinguished young congressmen and a number of able and distinguished young senators and new senators. And next year, we'll bring in a large number of new congressmen and new senators, and we'll carry out that platform. Don't think we won't."
But there were plenty of Dixiecrats to say, "Don't think you will." Right after the action of the Democratic Committee in expelling the Southerners, the state's writers set up shop in Washington and said, "They're in business to stay."
Just to keep the political pot boiling, senators and congressmen were in a row this week over who's going to get a vacation and when.
Many a representative had packed up and gone home even before the House voted itself a summer recess. Then the indignant Senate upset all tradition, refused to give its sanction for a holiday by the lower house. Voices and Events found a couple of congressmen who ventured opinions on this subject. Representative John Blatnick, a Minnesota Democrat, was back home in Minneapolis when we asked, "Why did the Senate refuse to let the House run its own business?"
"And the reason we feel in the House that the Senate turned us down was that it would spotlight them. You see, the public spotlight would be turned on them. Public attention would be turned on them. Here they are all alone, and they'd perhaps be prodded into action by public pressure and public opinion, you see. So they want us here, too, to sort of take the heat off them."
Well, rules are rules, so the House found a neat way to obey the letter of the law. Every 3 days, the House will meet, then recess, and thus satisfy the law. Of course, only a handful of members will be there. Many had gone long before. Now, take Congressman Thurston Morton. He's a Kentucky Republican. NBC's Robert McCormick reached him at home by telephone.
"Hello, is Mr. Morton there?"
"Hello, this is he."
"Oh, this is Bob McCormick in Washington, Mr. Morton.
How are you?"
"Oh, I'm all right, I guess. I wish I were home, too."
"You do."
"Mr. Morton, I don't want to seem inquisitive, but why did you leave town before the House voted its unofficial recess?"
"Well, there are two reasons. In the first place, I knew they were going to decide upon the recess. And in the second place, everybody was mad. Nobody was speaking to each other. All the speaking I heard was delivered from the floor. And I've heard those fellows so much in the last 8 months that I thought I could get along without listening to them, and I felt sure they could get along without me."
Page One News across the land this week, when the Federal Communications Commission ruled No more radio giveaways.
Yes, the radio giveaway program had become an American institution. But now, the commission said, such programs must be discontinued. There were many arguments pro and con. And one man thought to look ahead, now that the big prizes are declared illegal. What will the giveaway program of the future be like? Who else could tell it but NBC's Henry Morgan? And here's how funny man Morgan handled a winning contestant on what might be the giveaway quiz show of the future.
You've won, and now here is your reward. You have permission to duck behind the curtain and take a look at our great big refrigerator. But first, for being such a good sport,
yeah,
come over here and feel these Mars bars. And now... now I have a big surprise for you.
Yeah?
You have won our giant jackpot.
Yeah, yeah.
I want you, sir, to accept...
yeah, yeah.
On behalf of my sponsors and myself...
yeah, yeah.
My warmest personal regards.
This week, the hurricane season opened with a bang and a big blow.
Harry's hurricane, they call the first one, born in the southern hurricane breeding grounds earlier in the week. But it wasn't Harry's hurricane that did the damage this weekend. A brand new one with screaming winds and drenching rains pounded the Florida Gold Coast. Modern forecasting methods have lessened the danger considerably. Station WFLA at Tampa learned this from the base weather officer at MacDill Field.
The Joint Hurricane Center requests reconnaissance aircraft from the Air Force or Navy to fly the area for confirmation of the storm and to accurately determine its intensity. The Hurricane Center analyzes and digests the constant reconnaissance reports and forecasts the future track and intensity of the hurricane for 24-hour periods.
Forecast them? Yes. Stop them? No. At week's end, as the fierce, whirling winds struck Florida, they'd battened down for a big blow, and residents heard these ominous words from the forecasters. Station WIOD Miami took its microphones to the Miami Weather Bureau a scant 60 minutes before the full fury of the hurricane struck near Fort Lauderdale.
Here is the latest hurricane advisory issued at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time today. The hurricane was centered at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, very near the southeast Florida coast between Miami and Palm Beach, at latitude 26.3 north and longitude 80 west. It is still moving in a west-northwestern direction, around 16 to 18 miles per hour. Pressures are falling rapidly and winds are above 50 miles per hour.
And now, at this moment, that hurricane is just a heavy wind and rainstorm beating its way slowly north across South Carolina. However, a weather eye is being kept on massive tides, born in the storm-tossed Atlantic and possibly headed for the Georgia and South Carolina coast.
A world to which he brought song and laughter sorrowed this week as a grand old minstrel lay near death.
It was Winston Churchill who called him the grand old minstrel. Sir Harry Lauder. Sir Harry, the best-known Scotsman of his generation, with his jaunty Glengarry bonnet, the dazzling plaid of his McLennan kilt, bright buckle shoes, and that gnarled stick. All this was his trademark over the years when he quit the coal mines for the music halls. Now he's 79, his hair silver white. And this week, at his old stone house near Glasgow, doctors are battling to save his life. Today, the bedside bulletins are grave. Yet, it's hard to think of Sir Harry Lauder as anything but his sprightly old self. And voices and events found on the record of history these words of the grand old minstrel. Not just the voice, but the very spirit of Sir Harry Lauder.
Oh, boy. I seem to have the best job in the world. I make men and women, boys and girls laugh and sing. And the man that can do that today, why, he should go right on and on and on to the end of the road. Keep right on till the end of the road. keep right on to the end. If the way be long, let your heart be strong. Keep right on round the bend. Though you're tired and weary, still journey on till you come to your happy abode. Where all you love and you're dreaming of will be there at the end of the road.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
An angry exchange across the Atlantic this week as British and American newspapers and politicians dueled on the question of economic recovery and of socialism. The fight began in earnest when the London papers, which support the Labour government, splashed bitter headlines on dispatches from America. Reports of senators and congressmen blasting British socialism as a waste of American dollars. Editorials in conservative American newspapers denouncing the Labour government's policies. Well, now, to get the British view of all this, Voices and Events called on some leading editors and journalistic statesmen, and they gave us exclusively these comments. Listen first to Harry Ainsworth, editor of the Sunday newspaper, The People.
You, in America, have been given the impression that we are living a life of ease and partial luxury on martial aid. You have been told that we are building utopia at America's expense. Believe me, Britain today is no utopia. The rich in this country are no longer rich. Taxation, the highest in the world, takes care of that. Even the humblest working man pays his quota in heavy indirect taxation. The price of a pint of ordinary beer, for instance, is 28 cents, from which 15 cents goes in taxation. Cigarettes, which cost 95 cents for 20, carry a tax of 75 cents. Believe me, there's little applause in our country for this kind of utopia.
And next, the view of a ranking socialist, W.R. Richardson, who says,
I am a socialist. It is not socialism that has caused the dollar shortage. What angers many of us here is that some of your newspaper owners are blaming on a political creed which they dislike, a dollar problem which has been growing for a generation. Some of these people tell you that Britain is finished. The same kind of people probably said that George Washington was finished at Valley Forge. But history told a different story, and history repeats itself.
And perhaps the most bitter words on American criticism came from a distinguished exponent of Britain's socialist program. Voices and Events recorded these words from Kingsley Martin, editor of the liberal New Statesman and Nation.
Today, an American said to me, these anti-British attacks in our press are made by just those same conservative interests which lost power in America in 1932. They want to get it back. They've been attacking everything liberal and hopeful and constructive ever since. Such people are creating international bad feeling in the hope of getting a conservative government in England and improving the Republican prospect in America. In the same way, I'm ashamed to say, some British newspapers have been deliberately running down their country in order to discredit the present government. Their attacks make the headlines in the United States, and they, in turn, use the American headlines in the British press. So we have an international anti-labor alliance at work. The only remedy that I can see is for the liberals, both in England and America, also to unite and refuse to be made into enemies by their presses.
This, then, was the position taken by the left wing of British opinion. From the conservatives, of course, a different story. We hear it from Frank Owen, editor of the London Daily Mail.
The ordinary American citizen cannot possibly be more surprised at the sudden outburst of Anglo-American argument than the ordinary British citizen is. So I think I should try to explain that most of this present foolish quarrel has nothing whatever to do with the feelings of the ordinary man and the ordinary woman in Britain. They do not resent the reasonable criticism of Americans about the way in which American aid is being spent over here. It was 4 months ago that the politicians over here, who had been proclaiming that the Labour government had solved every problem, from rehousing to full employment and the creation of the biggest export market of all, suddenly realized that it wasn't going to last. Today, they're pretending that the United States Conservatives are ganged up with the British Conservatives to do down that experiment over here. Well, that's nonsense.
As statesmen pondered new international trends this week, there came to mind an unhappy anniversary.
10 years ago. But it may seem like longer. You thought $50 was a good weekly wage. Butter was 30 cents a pound, and so were pork chops. Ginger Rogers was playing in Fifth Avenue Girl at the Radio City Music Hall. Tallulah Bankhead was on Broadway in The Little Foxes. Goodbye, Mr. Chips and The Wizard of Oz were at your neighborhood movies. You smoked cigarettes at 15 cents a pack and hummed tunes like The Beer Barrel Polka, Deep Purple, and I'll Never Be the Same. And there were some of you who got up early in the morning, tuned in your radio to see where our world had gone while you slept. Anschluss, plebiscite, Sudetenland. Those were the words and headlines, and this was the voice you heard.
Sie haben das Recht, das deutsche Haupt nun wieder mit Stolz erhoben tragen zu dürfen. Wir alle aber haben die Pflicht, es nie wieder unter einen fremden Willen zu beugen. Dies sei unser Gelöbnis, so wahr uns Gott helfe.
You are listening to the Record of History, an actual broadcast from Berlin in the fall of 1939. 10 years ago, as Adolf Hitler addressed the faithful of the Nazi Party, one Germany, one people, one leader, this was the chorus of the master race.
Adolf Hitler, unser Führer, Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!
Deutschland über alles, then an anthem of hate. Yes, Berlin was calling America, an America of high emotion and little direction. Men in high places worried alone at night and talked gravely of the gathering storm. Not all of them, of course. There's also on the record of time this voice.
How horrible, fantastic, incredible it is that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing.
Time was catching up with Neville Chamberlain. Tall and gaunt, his inevitable umbrella clutched firmly in his hand, the British Prime Minister was beginning to show the strain, the tension of the time, yet he still spoke like this.
Tomorrow, Parliament is going to meet, and I shall be making a full statement of the events which have led up to the present anxious and critical situation. And first of all, I must say something to those who have written to my wife or myself in these last weeks to tell us of their gratitude for my efforts and to assure us of their prayers for my success. after my visits to Germany, I realized vividly how Herr Hitler feels that he must champion other Germans. He told me privately, and last night he repeated publicly, that after this Sudeten German question is settled, that is the end of Germany's territorial claims in Europe.
10 years ago. It was a warm fall weekend, like this one. Only a handful of men knew the day, the hour. In Berlin, the Reichstag was in session. America watched and listened. And then...
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this broadcast for some last-minute bulletins during the proceedings at the Reich. From the Associated Press, Warsaw. The Foreign Office said today that German planes had bombed Krakow and Katowice in southwestern Poland, Bern, Switzerland. The new Zürcher Zeitung correspondents in Berlin today wrote, "It is declared here categorically that the Führer's proclamation amounts to opening a state of war." Military operations.
That's how you learn that civilization had taken the plunge over the black horizon. All that was missing was the formality, the last ironic, polite gesture. It came at 6:15 in the morning on the first Sunday of September 1939. You could hear the bitter despair in his voice as Neville Chamberlain spoke to the world from number 10 Downing Street. This is the actual moment from history.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note, stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
10 years ago this week, the Second World War in history began. The legions of Nazi Germany marched, and there was no turning back. Yes, to the beat of these Nazi drums, the German nation marched to destruction. And what of this glory, 10 years and 22 million lives later? Here now are the voices of new leaders. It's Germany, 1949.
Wir Deutsche werden das niemals vergessen. Und wir werden dafür sorgen, wir, die wir an führender Stellung sind, dass diese führende Rolle, die die amerikanische Barmherzigkeit, die auf christlicher Grundlage beruht, gegenüber dem deutschen Volke in den schwersten...
This is the voice of Christian Democratic leader Konrad Adenauer, soon to be premier of the new West German Republic. He's saying, "We Germans thank God that we have our hardest days behind us." And for voices and events, still another voice from the ruins of Germany, Frau Luisa Schrader, former mayoress of Berlin during the airlift, a leading woman politician of the new state. We asked Frau Schrader, what's to be done now, these 10 years after?
The most necessary is to give work and to give bread to the people, because they have suffered so very much by the totalitarian government. They are friend of the democratic government.
The world has heard that before, but twice in a generation, Germany has brought war to a whole planet. Now, history alone can bear out this new promise of peace and democracy before another unhappy anniversary comes around.
This has been Voices and Events, the living record of history this week, compiled by the News and Special Events Department of the National Broadcasting Company. The actual voices of the people who made the news As They Made It. Your editor has been James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking, and inviting you to listen at this same time next week for Voices and Events.
You'll love the new wonderful Ethel Merman Show tonight on NBC. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.